Listening to the Arts Report on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded Musqueam territory of UBC's Point Grey campus. You probably already know that. My name is Jake Clark, and this is, well, we were calling it the Derailed Podcast, but we maybe might try jawboning for a little bit. It's like Chris Pratt's band in Parks and Recreation. The name might, you know, cycle through a few things. In any case, I'm joined today by Sola Fiedler, artist, former proprietor of the Soft Rock Cafe in Kitsilano, and presenter of Leap and the Loom Will Appear, which is currently on Granville Island and is a career retrospective of some very impressive tapestries. Sola, how are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Now, Leap and the Loom Will Appear, as we mentioned, is an interesting exhibition because of the medium involved. For those of our audience who are unfamiliar with textiles and tapestry, can you sort of unpack it a little bit? Like, what's the nature of some of the works presented?
Well, in the old days, there was no cameras or even painters who recorded the battle scenes as well as a large tapestry. And because there was no central heating either, a lot of the castles were kept warm by these gigantic tapestries hanging on the walls.
Like the Bayeux tapestry?
That is actually an embroidered kind of quilt. But it tells a story, and a lot of tapestries are telling very important stories. And I go to each Olympic city and capture it at that moment in time, and that's the story that I'm telling.
It's very interesting to read some of these exhibitions are tapestries for, as like Salt Lake City, which is a place that I don't know if many of our audience have a fixed image of it in our brain. What kind of symbols come into play when you're thinking of Salt Lake City?
Well, I generally think, because I was going to do the Olympics, I think of all the venues. So I'm thinking of the ski parks and the many venues that are spread out all over. So it's quite a large area for each tapestry to cover.
How large are the tapestries themselves?
They're mostly over 11 feet wide and 7 or 8 feet high. The Atlanta tapestry, I made a big mistake. I made it 17 feet high and 14 feet wide. And I didn't think, and where is this going to hang after you finished it? Because it needed a three-story space to hang in.
Well, and if you're hanging tapestries as insulation, you're not going to be able to hang it in Atlanta.
No. Most cities now don't have very high lobbies. Space is very valuable, and they don't normally now build those beautiful big lobbies and corporate entrances.
Because tapestries really do befit, like, grand halls, like sort of meeting areas. There's an almost epic tone.
That's my kind of tapestry. Very often tapestry artists learn that those are so difficult to sell that they better start making pieces that are like 2 feet by 3 feet and fit in an average residence.
Are those common, resident-sized tapestries?
Yes, that's a survival mechanism. I have now done recently several that are only 4 feet tall and can go behind the couch.
About the same size as like a large painting.
Yes.
Obviously, it's a different sort of discipline to create a tapestry as a painting. How long does it take to put together one of these epic tapestries, and what sort of work goes into that?
It takes 2 to 3 years. Usually that's between a summer and a winter Olympics. So I am usually racing from one city to the next city because literally every day counts. I finished the Sydney tapestry 1 hour before the opening ceremony.
And it was unveiled at the opening ceremony?
No, I actually did it. I like to do them in public. I pick a very public location, and people come and watch me actually work for 2 or 3 years. And that's an aid also in selling it.
And you're living in the city at this time?
Yes. I moved from country to country with the Olympics. And I must admit, I don't plan to do Paris 2024. If Calgary gets 2026, I'm there. But what I'm really looking forward to is LA for 2028. And I will be 92, right in the middle of the Olympics. So I'm going to celebrate my birthday standing in front of the LA tapestry. So I'm actually thinking 10 years ahead, thanks to the Olympic Committee. Usually they pick their city 6 years ahead, but they were kind enough to actually do a 10-year ahead. They awarded 2 summer games at the same time.
Well, that's a pretty terrific way to organize your travel schedule, too. Is there a favorite city that you've lived in while making these tapestries?
Actually, Vancouver. I did a tapestry of Vancouver for Expo 86. That was my very first tapestry, and it was bought and given to Jim Patterson as a thank you gift. And I thought, oh, this is a great thank you gift, and I can go anywhere in the world and do this. And I left the next day, and then I actually didn't come back for 30 years. But when we got the Olympics, I raced back here from Las Vegas, where I had spent 3 years doing the Vegas tapestry, which wasn't Olympics, but I had read of an article that said they were going to blow up all the lovely old hotels like the Stardust and the Sahara and the New Frontier and build condominiums on the strip. And I was so horrified. I raced there and did a huge tapestry of the entire 6.5 mile strip from the Mandalay Bay all the way up to the real city of Las Vegas, where the Golden Nugget is. And they were blowing up the hotels as I was working my way up the strip. So they blew up 5 while I was working on it, and they have blown up 6 since. So it becomes also a historical document. As you can imagine, the one I did for Expo 86, Vancouver looked like a little village. It only took me 3 months to do that tapestry, and the biggest building was the Hydro Building. Now, the last tapestry I did for Vancouver took me 5 years because the city has grown so much. And already since 2010, we've got a new stadium, maybe 50 new condominium towers, and it has just grown incredibly since even I did the one in 2010.
That's got to be quite a way to look at Vancouver too, especially because you were running the Soft Rock Cafe in Kitsilano in, what was it?
1976, I think I built. It was an old mattress factory with 2 huge empty lots on each side. And West 4th Avenue was pretty well deserted then. In any given block, there were maybe 2 businesses and a lot of empty buildings. Seafront radio station was opposite, and the Georgia Strait was just up the street.
Sorry about that, everyone. We're just going to have to pause for a minute as we do some ads and PSAs, but we'll get right back into that interview. That sounds amazing and is really, really interesting. Okay, talk to you guys in a bit.
Wanted to learn something new or make your own clothes? We've got you covered. Here at the AMS Knitting and Sewing Club, we provide you lessons on knitting, crochet, and sewing, and a space to craft your own projects and meet with other people that share your passions. Like us on Facebook at AMS Knitting and Sewing Club.
Without the help and support of our friends, we here at CITR wouldn't be able to bring you all the great music, art, cinema, and culture that you love. Thanks to the long-standing support from the Rio Theater, we are able to keep you informed on all the great artists, films, and everything else coming to town there. For all the current information about who and what's playing at the Rio Theater, visit their website at www.riotheater.ca.
Thanks for sticking in with us. We're right back to our segment on our kind of Pogfest segment, Jawbone with Sola Fielder. And we'll just get right back into that because it's really freaking interesting.
We're on the second floor. And so we often got the staff in for double espressos first thing in the morning. It was about 500 seats with a huge stage so I could get a band of maybe 12 people on it. And a big dance floor. And then on Friday nights, for sure, I brought in bands for the kids. There was no alcohol. That was the beauty of the place. Because I'd had 4 coffee houses in Yorkville in the 60s. And I knew I could survive on selling coffee. Whereas when I came to Vancouver, there were no coffee houses. And when I tried to borrow money, everyone said, all the banks, for instance. Well, if you put alcohol in there, you can have all the money you want, but coffee? No way. And if you can imagine Vancouver with no coffee houses, the only place I could get a coffee was to go over to Commercial Drive. They had espresso machines, you know, in their restaurants. But it was quite interesting because when we opened, we had to teach people what a cappuccino and a cafe au lait were. They had no idea.
Fast forward to now, you walk down West 4th, it's harder to find places where you can't get a coffee.
Yes.
Even if it's not a restaurant, they'll give one to you.
Exactly.
And with some of the acts booked, I sort of thinking about this because the venues in Vegas that you mentioned earlier are famous for iconic acts, and you hosted Ravi Shankar and Dexter Gordon, among others. I'm wondering if you had a favorite act or guest that you booked.
I think probably Oregon, which was a very, very fine jazz quartet. And literally, you'd have five people in there and you could hear a pin drop. But that was with many acts. There was such a respect for people who composed their own material and didn't play cover music. And I used to have many an argument with BMI and ASCAP because they would want to license me. And I'd say, nobody plays cover material under my roof. And that was part of the attraction because many singer-songwriters and bands got their start there because they wanted to perform their own material, and that was really important to them. And in the 60s, back in Toronto, like the kids, my very first coffee house, these kids would come in and play, sit in the corner, and we'd actually pass the hat. And it was Joni Mitchell and Gordon Lightfoot and Neil Young and David Clayton Thomas and many people that have gone on. In fact, they didn't want to work for passing the hat, and I had to build a bigger coffee house of 140 seats. But then we ran out of performers because there weren't enough in Canada, and I would drive to Greenwich Village in New York and sign up anybody I found in those little clubs. So it would be Richie Havens and James Taylor and Chris Christopherson, and they were just kids. They were just starting out. It was amazing. And even then, I was trying to find women artists to equally balance out the number of men. I thought about the other day, and it was really tough. There were about 10 male artists to every female, and there was Judy Collins and Caroline Hester and a few others, but there were way more many men in that business in those days.
It was very hard to break in as a woman.
It wasn't hard to break into a coffee house. On Yorkville, there must have been about 20 of them. And we were all open all the time. I was open till 6 o'clock in the morning, every day.
6 in the morning, no alcohol.
Packed. Absolutely packed. Every seat taken.
So everyone's there like, okay, we want to hear something original. That's where you go.
Some of them hadn't even had an album out at that point. But there was this underground that knew all about them.
The Subterraneans.
And there'd still be lineups around the block at 2 o'clock in the morning. And there'd be like 12 inches of snow. And those people were so determined. This is maybe, you know, the only way they could hear them.
Well, it's like the greatest thing when you're running any kind of venue is when you see the queue.
Yeah.
I think that's a line from 24-Hour Party People, was that they said in the book, I think. Apropos of breaking in, there was one thing you said to me earlier about making it as an artist, which you've done with great aplomb. And but it is a tough business. And you're telling me, was it 98% of art students after 2 years are no longer pursuing
making art?
And I just want to know what your feel is on that, what you're thinking of the scene right now, how a lifetime of making art brings to bear.
Well, fortunately, nobody ever told me that statistic. I was making art for a long time on my own, and then I went to the Vancouver School of Art, which was downtown on Dunsmuir, and I was 36 years old. I didn't have a portfolio like a young student would have, but they accepted me. They said, oh, this will be fun. If you're an older person, it'll be fun for the students to hang out with you. So I wanted to work with textiles, and there was nobody to teach me, so they just gave me the money to buy all my own materials, and I used the art school as a studio space. I made all kinds of sculptures in ropes and twine, and I sold each piece as I went along, and I thought, oh, this is a great business to be in. And then after about 2.5 years, I asked my teacher, I said, so if I get a degree, you know, what will that mean? He said, oh, you can teach. And I thought, I don't want to teach. So I left the next day and went and opened an art gallery, a studio art gallery on the front of where the stores are in Deep Cove, and did extremely well making and selling my sculptured three-dimensional textile pieces and some wall hangings. And then I, as I said, I wanted a coffee. I went downtown, couldn't find one, went to Commercial Drive, and on the strength of a double cappuccino, came back and found that building on West 4th Avenue. So I had a lot of pieces, and I hung them in the coffee house, and they all sold quite quickly. And that was one of the things I realized. If you sit down for 20 minutes and have a coffee, you can fall in love with a piece of art. And most art galleries, that doesn't happen. People come in, they walk around, they walk out of the door. They do not give themselves time to fall in love with it. So selling your art in a coffee house or a restaurant, or where they're trapped in front of the baggage carousel in the airport, or someplace where people are trapped for 20 minutes, they have time to fall in love with and buy your art.
Is there coffee at Leap in the Loom Will Appear?
No. This was just one of the I love recycled buildings, and I've done many. And Granville Island, of course, is filled with them. And 6 weeks ago, I went down to visit an art show, and Jennifer Windsor said, "Why don't I? This is a pop-up for 2 weeks." And she said, "Why don't you rent it for 2 weeks?" So I did, and it's quite a big undertaking. You've got to have insurance and above the things like rent, and you do have to have a publicist, otherwise nobody knows you're there. Art is quite a business nowadays. And mostly I've figured out a lot of things. If you can make art and do reproductions, like a print of a tapestry, my first run of prints was 10,000 off what my Key West tapestry. I sold them in 9 months, and that provided a wonderful cash flow that got me through to the next tapestry, just in case that original piece, whatever it is, doesn't sell. You can make prints, and most people have got like $25 in their pocket. They don't have $25,000 for that original piece. So that's one of the ways that, as an artist, you can survive. I'll be at 1359 Cartwright on Granville Island for the next 2 weeks. And if any student wants to come down and talk to me about how to survive making art, I've had a lot of experiences, including opening more than one gallery. I've opened three. I've been all over the world selling art, not just in North America. I've been to Australia and, you know, a few other places. And I've come across a few ways that you can survive, including doing the piece in public, which most artists wouldn't think of doing. They do it in private in their studio, where no one can see them making mistakes. I don't mind making mistakes in public. I'm just unpicking it. And sometimes the public actually points out, because they know what I'm trying to depict, and they'll say, "You didn't get the color of that bridge right." And often they're right.
Like heckling you?
Sort of. But, you know, I really enjoy actually talking to people while I'm working on something like that, because there's a real emotional connection. They will come up to my tapestry and they'll point and say, "That's my house." Or they'll point and say, "That's the hotel where I'm staying."
So if you maybe want to chime in a little in that respect,
1359 Cartwright Street on Granville Island, and we're open from 11 till 6. And I would welcome anybody, you know, who just wants to come down and look and touch the art. My art is made all from recycled materials, so 100 hands have already touched that sweater that I've unraveled, or that bikini that I'm cutting up. I put all kinds of clothes and jewelry and furs into my work, and I love people, and especially kids, to touch it, and that's usually totally forbidden in any art gallery.
Well, there you go. Go give the tapestry a feel, learn a little about art. Sola, it was terrific to have you.
Oh, thank you.
I'm sorry, but if no one goes to Sola's art thing, I might actually die. I love her already. I like really love art galleries that like let you touch the art.
Yeah,
that's so like cool. A huge plus for me. I think that's so cool, because like it's just like it's another way to just be like a part of the like artwork. Oh man, I really want to go now. That was such an interesting talk.